And the way it's all connected up, we can't really explain all of it because it ruined the book. But I thought you did a really amazing job in this because this falls between everything. Is it a thriller? Yeah, sort of. Is it a detective story? Sort of. Is it a history? Sort of. It's all those things, and it doesn't fit in any one box, and that makes, I think, for better books.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess I would call it historical fiction, although it does toggle back and forth between both Scotland and the main mid-coast, which is a place that I love, and thank you for the kind words. But I was always taught to write about what you know and write about what you love. And I love curling, and I certainly love the main mid-coast.
Well, before we get to coming upon curling, which I'm one of the few people I know that I watch it on TV when it's on because I like watching it. You have a background in the law. You work for a number of nonprofits. You did some other things. How much of your legal training helped you write this book? Now, and I'm not, I know there's criminal law involved in this, and that wasn't your expertise, but how much were you, did it help to have that law background?
It certainly helped quite a bit. As you know, there are a couple of courtroom scenes in the book, and in order to understand those, I had to learn about some couple hundred year old Scottish laws and how they might apply to a case, as well as some unique aspects of Maine law. So it certainly helped to create a couple of little twists and turns in the plot.
So what we're going to do now is just set for our listeners to go back, because it's been a couple of weeks. The story begins. We have a man in his 50s. He's a lawyer. He's able to retire. He has lost his beloved wife. And shortly after that, loses his beloved dog. Things are not going well in his life. And he becomes quite interested in to the point of obsession with genealogy. How did that first come into your mind when thinking about the book?
It's really interesting, and I think it crept in subconsciously, not consciously. Because in the last couple of years, I had always known that I was adopted as a very, very young boy, 3 or 4 days old, and actually sent away a couple of years ago before I started writing this book for my original birth certificate from the state of New Jersey, in which I found who my teenage birth mother was. And digging a little deeper, I came across the only picture that I have ever seen of her, which is a single black and white photograph. And as you know, an old black and white photograph plays a significant part in the story. So I didn't make that conscious connection while writing, but I think that probably triggered something.
One of the things that the book, we learn from the book, and Rich and other books, we learn things, is that Ailsa Craig is where the best curling granite in the world comes from. It's the most highly prized. And I think people who don't understand the roaring game, as it's known, think of it as just something you play on a smooth sheet of ice, but really it isn't. It's pebbled and it makes the noise, and you got to do a lot of things to make it work. It's a very sophisticated game, but it doesn't look that way maybe to the person on television. Did that help you with plotting this out? I mean, because it seemed like the plot of this was sort of like, if I don't win this end, we're over.
I tried to both explain the game and, you know, how it's played and the complexities of the game. It's sometimes called chess on ice because of the strategy involved. But I didn't necessarily want to make it a book about curling. Curling is, to me, the connective tissue that ties the story together, because some folks in old Scotland curl, and there is the granite from Ailsa Craig, but there is also the narrator who becomes a rather avid curler and quite obsessed with curling.
And I think what's so great is that people here can now, if they read the book, they can go to the Belfast Curling Club when things open up again in the fall and watch and see and how it works. But what I found really interesting was this sort of traveling curling nation, all these teams from Canada and the Eastern U.S. that go to the Bonn Spiel every weekend during the season. That's not something that I think, I mean, clearly it happens, but it's not something most people are aware of. I mean, they know about travel hockey and they know about AAU basketball, but this kind of amateur group trying to become as professional as they can really struck me as quite amazing. Do you find that to be true of those people because you know them?
I do. It's a pretty close community because so few people curl in the United States, and particularly in Maine, there are not a whole lot of curlers, most of them centered around Belfast. But as coincidence would have it, I'm heading over to New Hampshire this weekend to play in a Bonn Spiel. But you meet some of the same people, but you meet people from all around the country who just love this game, love the social aspect of it. Of course, the winning team buys a drink for the losers after the games. So yeah, it's a great community. It's a really, really social event. And you mentioned the Belfast Curling Club. I would encourage anyone with some interest in curling to head over there in the fall, look at their website, and sign up for a Learn to Curl, where they will teach you how to play.
We're talking with David S. Florig about his book, The Stones of Ailsa Craig. David, did you have to travel much to research this book, or did travel provide the basis and the inspiration for the book?
Surprisingly to some, I have never been to Scotland.
Wow.
But I did hundreds upon hundreds of hours of research, reading Scottish newspaper accounts from the 1700s and 1800s and old, historic curling club minutes and looked at a lot of online old Scottish historic curling sites and learned a lot about the volcanic island of Ailsa Craig where the granite is found.
As someone who's been to Scotland several times, you fooled me. I would have thought that you had been there because of the appreciation of what the landscape looks like. The Scottish connection to Belfast and the connection to the genealogy, you also at some point had to know something or study something about the Scottish clans. My maternal side of the family are McFarlanes, and I've read a lot about the matriarchal clans and all that. To get to the gist of what causes the major twist in this story, I assume you did some research in that too. I'm trying not to give anything away.
Yeah, not to give too much away, but the genealogy part of the book and the main story in the book do come from learning about some Scottish customs, some clans, some family connections, some old Scottish traditions, all of those things.
Well, and you always have to be very careful with the Scots, because I once told the late great Celtic fiddler Johnny Cunningham that my mother's family were McFarlanes. He took two steps back and he said, "You don't want to be telling people that if you're over in Scotland that they don't like care for them." It turned out that their clan song is "Lifting the Queues" or "Stealing the Cows," and a full moon is known as McFarlane's Lantern. And there's some current song or some contemporary song that says, "You need a dirty job, give it to a McFarlane." So I have kept that very quiet over the years. Just say my mother has got some Scottish ancestry.
Yeah, the Scottish clans are interesting. Scottish weddings have some traditions based on clans and maybe clan rivalries, drinking from a two-handled cup, for example, called a quaich, symbolizes that you're not holding a weapon in one hand because you're using both hands to hold the cup. Little things like that describe the interrelationships between clans.
When you were getting near the end of the book, I'm asking this writer to writer here, you're getting near the end of the book, there's always a tendency to want to wrap everything up in a bow, and I thought you miraculously didn't do that. I really like the fact that, as a mentor of mine would said, that part of the story was over, and so it was okay to stop. Did you ever think, man, maybe I should go a little further with this, or did you just know when you hit it that was the time to stop?
I knew that you know, trying to explain further what had happened was a little bit pointless. I mean, the reader is going to draw their own conclusion of you know, why things happened and should they have happened. I know people who don't like the ending at all because of, you know, a bit of a loose end. But
well, yeah,
I knew it was time. I knew that the reader had had enough and hopefully had some things to think about.
That's a really good way to put it. The reader's had enough. I'll have to remember that one. Some of my students, given readings, when you've talked, I know you've done a lot of them along, especially in the Mid-Coast and the like. Because you describe Belfast as if you're looking right at it. I mean, I'm there almost every day at some point. Do you find that the local folks really gravitate to it because they, oh, I know where that is, I know where that is, or I know where that is?
Exactly. I mean, everywhere I go, you know, there's a story about the Broiler Festival from back in the 1940s right. and 1950s, and people will tell me, yeah, my grandparents went to that. Or I even had one person tell me that my whatever she was relative was a broiler queen at one of the festivals. So it's fascinating, but Belfast is sort of my home away from home. My wife and I come and vacation there a couple of times a year. We just love it.
Well, I don't live far away, so next time you're up, you know, shoot me an email and we'll get together and raise one.
Or two.
Or two, yeah, that's all right. Definitely can raise two. And if you come out to the farm, we can raise five or six, but only two if I'm in town. Well, David, thank you so much. I really, really enjoyed the book. I enjoyed meeting you at the fundraiser, and hope to see you again soon. And if you get a new book, let us know.
Sounds good. Thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
David S. Florig, the book is The Stones of Ailsa Craig. And you did a nice job, Bruce, walking that tightrope of discussing the book without any spoilers involved.
I've been driving around since a little after noon running errands, and I kept going through my head all the time, how am I going to talk about this without tipping it off? Because you don't want to be tipped off, people.
No.
You really, really want to see what happens.
What's coming up next week on Sports Lit?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm hoping we'll be talking with Steve LaFoley, who wrote Shadowboxing. We're trying to nail that down. If not, I'll put something up a day or two ahead on social media, and I would assume it will probably be either Reg Lansbury's newest manuscript.
Oh, nice.
About Calvin Hill and Brian Dowling and those great days at Yale, or it'll be some new poetry from some friends of the show.
Excellent.
So we'll have something.
Looking forward to it. By the way, Josh D'Alessio wanted us to make sure and mention, too, in case people weren't aware, that the HEART program that Josh was talking about has an outreach team, and their job is to support and mitigate the impact of the homeless on downtown Bangor businesses, and they're working very hard to make that work for everybody and doing what sounds like a terrific job so far at their program over on Hancock and Newbury, the old Viner Brothers building.
And I certainly like the idea of mental health professionals dealing with people as opposed to making it law enforcement's job.
Yeah.
Law enforcement doesn't want to do it. They're not trained to do it. It's not their fault that gets thrown at them.
And just giving people a place to go where they can feel welcome and get out of the elements, or just, you know, sit down someplace comfortable for a half hour or so.
Yeah, my son, who's a, you know, firefighter paramedic in Augusta, says all the time that the biggest problem is these people have no place to go and
Absolutely.
No one to listen to them.
That's right. It's a 4:46 here on Downtown Wednesday afternoon. Still to come, Sean McAdam talks Red Sox with us in the 5 o'clock hour. When we come back, a look at what's going on here on Downtown.
Hi, this is Liz Bassi, and you're listening to Downtown with Richard Kimball.
I really wanna know how deep you want to.
Feel more confident and in control of your financial life. Ameriprise Advisors can work with you to provide personalized, goal-based advice based on your short and long-term goals. Plus, you can track your investments and financial solutions with our digital tools and regular meetings. Call Ameriprise Private Wealth Advisor Michael Toole at 207-307-7718. That's 207-307-7718. Office is located at 23 Water Street, Suite 405, Bangor, 04401. Ameriprise Financial Services, LLC, member FINRA and